I learned how to speak English over less than a summer by watching television. And what I was watching was actually Sesame Street. I'll tell you that I didn't think it was in the United States
Really?
because it was so different from what was out, outside my door in Boiling Springs.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Monique Trung came to America as a 7-year-old girl, a Vietnamese refugee whose family landed in small town North Carolina. She told me that the 3 years she spent in Boiling Springs shaped so much of her life. It's where she first learned English, where she first faced prejudice, where she started to develop her identity. Trung has written 3 novels, including one called Bitter in the Mouth, that recalls that North Carolina time through fiction. I first ran across her in an essay where she described her love for Bridges, one of the great American barbecue joints, located in Shelby near where she grew up. But even that love for her came by an indirect path. In so many ways in her life, Monique Trung has taken the long way home. Here's our conversation. So, Monique, you spent a key part of your childhood in a little town called Boiling Springs, North Carolina, about an hour west of Charlotte. Tell folks how you ended up there and what those years were like for you.
Well, the years were from 1975 to 1978. I was 7 years old by the time that we came to Boiling Springs. And how does a Vietnamese family end up in Boiling Springs, I think is your question.
Well, I know it's not a simple question.
Well, my family and I were refugees from the Vietnam War, and we were sponsored by a man named Van Peeler. And he lived in Boiling Springs, and he was someone that my father knew from Vietnam. And he was kind enough to sponsor us, and that was really the only way that you as a refugee could leave a relocation camp, right? You had to have a sponsor. For me, I was... I went from the first to fourth grade there, right? And it, no lie, it was a difficult number of years because there were really no other Asian American, not to mention Vietnamese, children in my school. So I was really the only one, and I was unfortunately targeted for being just me,
You've written in a couple of essays about that time. There are these great pictures of you twirling a baton in, I think, the Shelby Christmas Parade. Shelby is the big city if you're in Boiling Springs. I'm wondering if you have specific memories about doing that, because it seems like, as somebody who was sort of targeted and people looked at you funny and that sort of thing, to sort of march up and down the street in front of this crowd would seem like exacerbating those things. Is that how you felt?
The baton twirling years of my life were brought on by my mother, or initiated by my mother. I think folks around her said, let's try to get Monique kind of more integrated, into what other little girls were doing in Boiling Springs. And so she signed me up for baton twirling. I honestly could not understand what this was all about. I mean, the entire time, I thought, why why am I spinning this thing? Why am I throwing it above my head and risking, you know, getting a concussion? It's one of those, everything was so odd and strange for me during those years that it was just another, you know, of the long list of inexplicable things that were expected of me.
So I know sometimes in these situations, it's easier for kids to sort of assimilate because there's a shorter history in their lives and that sort of thing than for adults. Was that true in your case? Did your parents have a more difficult time fitting in than you did?
I think in my family, my mother and father had a little bit of an easier time because they both were fluent in English as well as French. So, you know, the language barrier is always, always the biggest hurdle, I think, you know, for refugees and migrants and immigrants. So they were equipped in that way. And my father had spent his youth in France and in England. For them also, they understood sort of, the bigotry and the racism that they might have faced. I, on the other hand, had no understanding of what was the rationale for the behavior of people, children, you know, really towards me. And that not knowing, not understanding why all of a sudden I was being perceived as such a freak or just something to be mocked. You know, that not knowing was really, really painful.
As you've written about these struggles, both in your nonfiction essay work and in fiction, you've also written about things from that time in your life that you really enjoyed or that you came back to and were moving one way or the other. And the way I came to your work was by reading an essay you wrote in the Washington Post back in 2012, I think, about Bridges Barbecue Lodge in Shelby, which is, for those of you who don't know, one of the great barbecue places in North Carolina, which means it's one of the great barbecue places in the world. We moved away, but came back to, what is it about that place that is so special to you?
I think the first time I actually had a meal at Bridges was, you know, like you said, not while my family and I were living in Boiling Springs. It was actually much later when I went back to the area because one of my husband's best friends here was marrying a gal from Shelby. And they were having a proper Southern wedding where there were, you know, a whole weekend of events. And I had said to myself, I never want to go back because it was such a hurtful sort of set of years for me. And I decided that I would go. And that was really a necessary step for me as a person. It was part of that opening up of my heart, you know, and my consciousness about the area and the people. I think that's why that place, you know, besides the fact that it's so delicious, you know.
Right, I was gonna say, you picked a good place.
I mean, we were there. We were in the area for just a weekend, but we ate there twice. One of the sort of things that I realized about a place like Bridges is that it is such a part of the community, right? And it is so special to everyone. And it made me wonder why my mom and I never went there. You know, why did we eat at all the fast food joints? You know, why did we go to the Pizza Inn? You know, besides the fact that it had a all-you-can-eat buffet.
Well, I was going to say, growing up in Georgia, the Pizza Inn was a big part of my childhood, too.
It took some time to think it through. And, you know, my mom loves barbecue. We love pig. You know, so that should have drawn us to the place. And I think it really had to do with the fact that there was this kind of fear that we had that if we went into a place that was so community oriented, you know, that maybe we wouldn't be welcomed.
Right. It's a place where, even if this is not literally true, it feels like a place where everybody knows everybody.
That's right.
And they didn't know you, right? So you've talked about not just barbecue, but Southern literature, things like Carson McCullers and writers like that, as being sort of a homecoming for you.
I think I recognize myself and the sort of context of a place like Boiling Springs. I recognize that for the first time on the pages of you know, books like To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. You know, it's a different kind of recognition than anything that I had read previously. You know, because it's regional. It's talking about something highly specific. And even though there's clearly no Asian characters in any of these books except Carson McCullers, I think it's that really that recognition that makes it feel like these authors are speaking to me.
You've had three novels, all very well received. But the one I want to talk about kind of the most today is your second one, Bitter in the Mouth, because it's sort of the most Southern, and the lead character in there is at least a version of you. And there's one little detail I want to ask about first, which is that one of the traits of your character and her best friend is that they are gigantic Dolly Parton fans. And I wanted to ask whether that was something that was true in your life as well.
I'm a huge fan of Dolly Parton now because I didn't understand her then. You know, and when I say that, I really do mean that to me, exactly the way that I describe her in Bitter in the Mouth, she was a mystery to me. She felt very American, but not American, like something on top of American, you know?
That's fair.
And everything was big and everything was perfect. I mean, I'll tell you that the reason why I'm such a huge fan of her now is because I now am more aware of her music, you know, of how that she is a lyricist. She is also whatever joke you thought she was or is, she told the joke, you know, the joke's on you, you know, in that she, you know, has made an incredible, lucrative, creatively nourishing you know, just sort of life for herself. And she's in control.
I wonder, as I was reading that and thinking about this character who is sort of learning America, I guess, through listening to Dolly Parton in some ways, whether there were any parallels in your own life, this childhood in Boiling Springs, whether it was like TV or music or movies or anything that sort of taught you about being an American.
Yeah. I learned how to speak English over less than a summer by watching television. And what I was watching was actually Sesame Street. I'll tell you that I didn't think it was in the United States.
Really?
Because it was so different from what was out, you know, outside my door in Boiling Springs. I remember there were, you know, once in a while there'd be segments where they teach you words in Spanish. And I was like, what? What is this? This is other language, you know, that's spoken on this street. But yeah, so I was so lucky that I came over at a time in my life where language acquisition was as easy as turning on television and just watching, you know? And then it kind of seeped into me. So yeah, television was everything to me.
When we come back, Monique Trung talks about the recent violence against Asian Americans and why she takes her passport everywhere she goes.
I thought, I really did, that if I didn't have proof of my citizenship, you know, the authorities, whoever these, you know, would stop me.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Have you ever felt the urge to slow down, exit the highway, and get lost exploring the back roads? Maybe you need a break from big box strip malls that have been power washed of any local personality? If so, plug your earbuds into Vanishing Postcards, a podcast with Texas native Evan Stern. He'll take you on an adventurous road trip exploring the dives, traditions, and threatened histories that can be found hidden off the interstates. Featuring stories collected over a 1,500-mile journey, Vanishing Postcards is an immersive, touching, and frequently humorous experience. Digital Trends named it one of the best podcasts of 2021. If you feel like coming along for the ride, find Vanishing Postcards wherever you get your podcasts. And now, back to my conversation with Monique Trung. So the main character, Linda, in this book has synesthesia, which is, I'm going to oversimplify it, but it's sort of a blending of the senses. And her form of it is that when she hears words, they come with flavors, tastes. For example, her own name, Linda, tastes like mint. And the word later is pimento cheese. Do you have synesthesia?
I don't have synesthesia.
I was wondering, so what gave you the interest in doing this with this character?
I'm someone who thinks constantly about food.
Join the club.
And I had written, you know, a novel from the point of view of a living cook in the home of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. And so that book was very much about celebrating flavors, right? And sort of culinary prowess. But I didn't want to sort of, again, write about food from that perspective. I wanted a different kind of angle. I had seen a television show where they were interviewing a man that had this particular form of synesthesia, and you could see on his face every time he heard or if he spoke a word that was pleasurable, you know, and there was like a subjective pleasure that was happening to him, or if it was distasteful to him. And it sparked so much in me, because I've always thought of language as being subjective. You know, of course, there is the objective language, because otherwise you and I would not be able to communicate with each other. But all of us, whether we have synesthesia or not, attach certain meanings, certain memories to specific words that are our own.
Do you feel like that's true of places too? I mean, obviously, you know, as you said, you only spent 3 years of your life in Boiling Springs. You lived in, at least as far as I could tell, Texas and Ohio, and now in New York City. But I think a lot of what you've written proportionally is about North Carolina or that time. Does that place, do you feel like there's an out of proportion attachment to that place for you?
I've written about how I feel that I was reborn, you know, when my family and I came to Boiling Springs. And, you know, of course, the term reborn has a lot of different connotation. And I don't necessarily mean the religious meaning, but rather the meaning that I did become a different person, whether I meant to or not, you know, because I was being perceived as a different person. But I think, especially given that I'm a writer, there's a kind of rebirth that happens when you acquire a new language. I started dreaming in English.
It does seem to me that this book at its core is about sort of secret identities. Many of the characters in the book have things about themselves that are hidden from most, if not all, of the other people in their lives. And I'm wondering if this book is crafted that way because you felt that way about yourself as an Asian girl in North Carolina. Did you feel like, even though people clearly knew that you were different in that way, did you feel like you had some sort of secret identity?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there is a lot of secrets in that novel. And I think I was approaching it in terms of one of the hallmarks of a Southern Gothic novel, you know, is sort of the secret, right? The secret person, or secretive person, or for example, Boo Radley, you know. That seemed to me very, very much a part of what I wanted to play with, because I did conceive of that novel as a kind of reimagining of a Southern Gothic novel, you know. And when you say, like, how, when you ask about how it relates to me, how I thought about it was that what would happen if Boo Radley was the narrator of the story, you know? And to me, Linda is Boo Radley, you know? She's the one that people don't want to see. She's the open secret.
You talked about this difficulties you had being kind of singled out when you were younger. It makes me think about how there's been a focus lately on all these acts of violence against Asian Americans here. And some of that obviously has happened in New York where you live, some of the more notorious incidents, I guess. And I'm wondering how that's affected your life. Is that something that you have always felt and is just now sort of coming to the rest of our attention? Or is it something that you feel has changed more recently?
It breaks my heart. These incidents of targeted Asian Americans, especially the elderly Asian Americans. I'll tell you that I think this is one way of answering it. I carry around my U.S. passport all the time. What does that say to you? I am so fearful, not just that some random person will reach out and hurt me, but that especially, especially during the Trump administration, I felt incredibly at risk. I really did that if I didn't have proof of my citizenship, the authorities, whoever these, would stop me and deport me, or, I'm a lawyer. I should feel empowered. I should feel like I know the law. And yet there is a part of me that is so deeply fearful, not of just the individual, but of the state. And that's heartbreaking.
Do you feel like that comes from, and I'm not talking about how you're reacting to it, how the outside in, I guess, comes from the same place as those kids calling you names when you were 7?
This is such an odd thing to say, but I've just only recently realized that I had decided in my life not to have children, because I didn't know how I would protect my child from something like what I had gone through. For a long time, I thought, it's because I don't have a maternal instinct, or, my life, is this or that. And it's only, now I'll be 53 this year. And it's only now, it's taken all this time to understand how much those years and the helplessness that I felt has affected me, and how I went on to live, the subsequent years of my life.
Monique, I want to circle just back around to, this is a podcast about the South after all. I know you've lived in Brooklyn for a good while. I'm going to ask this question two different ways and answer whatever fits best. Is there a time up there that you feel the most Southern? Or when you want to feel Southern and you're in Brooklyn, what do you do?
I feel most Southern in Brooklyn when I try to find a good biscuit.
Ain't easy, is it?
It makes me cry. I mean, I don't even try to find good barbecue up here. I'm not crazy. I'll wait. I'll just wait.
Imagine being 7 years old and dropped into a mystery the way Monique Trum was. Not only did she land in a new country, she landed in sort of a country within a country, a place place that has been so often unkind to outsiders. The world of Sesame Street, where everyone cared about one another and everyone got along, was not the world outside her window in the South. That time changed her, made her fearful. Maybe, even as she now says, maybe it kept her from having children so they wouldn't go through what she did. But still, she also remembers the beauty of the trees and the taste of biscuits. And those things changed her too. There are a lot of country songs about being a simple man. Simple men and simple women don't exist. Monique Trung, like all of us touched by the South, is a complicated person who grew up in a complicated place. And the thing about it is, you can't really separate out the beauty and the sorrow. They blur in the memory. They blend on the tongue. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.